From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Rachel Martin. Democrats are stunned, and so are Republicans. Donald Trump, the businessman turned reality TV star turned GOP nominee, has pulled ahead and is very close to turning into a president-elect.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Hillary Clinton's path to the White House, considered likely just hours ago, is crumbling. Right now, Trump is leading the Electoral College 244 to 215.
So what happened? We're trying to answer that as we wait for final results from the few remaining toss-up states.
Eyes are on Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, and New Hampshire, which are all leaning toward Trump.
In the Senate races, Republicans defended two key seats, Indiana and North Carolina, but lost one, Illinois.
Democrats held on to their seat in Nevada and will send a Latina to the Senate, a first.
A night full of surprise. Stay with us. And we're going to turn now to NPR's senior political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, give us the lay of the land.
Well, as you noted, Donald Trump is at 244 electoral votes, and Hillary Clinton is only at 215. And the states we are still waiting on that the Associated Press has not called at this point that are key to what happens with the outcome tonight: Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Arizona, and the two congressional districts in Nebraska and Maine. That's all that's left, and Donald Trump is leading in all of them right now except for the one congressional district in Nebraska, in fact. So if Donald Trump were to pull off Wisconsin, the path is all but gone for Hillary Clinton. She would have to pull off something very stunning, which would be to win Michigan, where she's behind right now, win Pennsylvania, where surprisingly she's behind, mm-hmm. win New Hampshire, and it's been close there. And that would just bring her to about 269, 269 if she got a split in the two congressional districts, and 270 if she were to get the one congressional district in Maine. But that is not looking like the path right now. The more likely scenario is that Donald Trump wins and becomes the next president of the United States.
We've been following the electoral vote. What's the popular vote looking like?
The popular vote right now is 48.3 for Trump, 47.1 for Clinton, with about 53,700,000 votes for Trump, 52,470,000 votes for Hillary Clinton.
Mara Liasson, we have not spent a lot of time over this campaign talking about the policies that a Trump White House would enact, partly because Trump himself always sort of resisted talking about policies beyond a few big headline items, the wall, the Muslim ban, etc. What would a Trump administration look like? What would its priorities be?
Well, we're not sure, as you just said. I think that he would sign a lot of bills that were sent to him by the Republican Congress, and it looks like we will have Republican control of everything. One of the best stories that was reported this year, I think it was in the Washington Post, was that Donald Trump Jr. went to the chief of staff for John Kasich to feel out whether Kasich would be willing to be the vice president on Donald Trump's ticket. And he, according to this story, he said, Kasich said, well, I don't know if I want to do that. And Donald Trump Jr. said, well, you'd have a very big portfolio. You'd be in charge of policy. And Kasich's guy said, well, what kind of policy? And Donald Trump Jr. said, foreign and domestic. And Kasich's chief of staff said, well, what will Donald Trump be doing? He'll be making America great again. So when Donald Trump has talked about this, he's talked about being a cheerleader for America. He said Obama never did that. So maybe he wants to leave the policy portfolio to Mike Pence.
So the answer to your question is
we don't know. We don't know. We do know he wants to. He's been very, very specific and clear on a couple of things. He wants to rip up trade deals, renegotiate NAFTA, declare China a currency manipulator. He wants to potentially stop protecting our NATO allies unless they pay up. He wants to build the wall. We know that. And the Muslim ban, which has changed a bit. We're not quite sure what shape it'll take.
But Mara,
he wants to get rid of Obamacare.
His signature issues, though, he still needs Congress to some degree.
He still needs Congress. And it's very possible
he's railed against executive orders, so I can't imagine he's...
He'll undo all the Obama executive orders. He's also, you know, his supporters, of course, have the way it's been described is they take him very seriously, but not literally. In other words, they don't care if he really builds the wall and makes Mexico pay for it.
Mara, the last thing you mentioned was repeal Obamacare, which is something Republicans in Congress have been trying to do every year since Obamacare was passed. If, in fact, they do control the House and Senate and the White House, that seems like something that they could plausibly do.
They absolutely could. They're kind of like the dog that caught the car. Now they're going to have to do something with it. They want to repeal Obamacare. They've tried 50-something times. Now they can. But it's going to be complicated because they've said they want to keep all the popular parts of Obamacare. And how are they going to pay for those if you get rid of the individual mandate? It all falls apart.
NPR's Scott Horsley has been looking into what a Trump administration might look like and is here to talk about it. Hey, Scott.
Good to be with you, Ari.
So what would it look like?
Well, Mara mentioned the executive orders, and because President Obama has been exceptionally reliant on executive orders in the face of a hostile Republican Congress, there are a lot of executive actions that the president has taken that Donald Trump can undo with the stroke of a pen. One of the most notable, of course, is the Clean Power Plan. That is an executive action to restrict coal-fired power plants. It's the cornerstone of President Obama's climate agenda and the U.S. contribution to the Paris Climate Accord. So that could be undone immediately, really, with President-elect Trump. But Mara is also right that Trump has not been unduly burdened with a policy prescription. He doesn't have a thick book of policy prescriptions the way Hillary Clinton does. And he's been pretty flexible about his own prescriptions. You know, he put forward a multi-trillion dollar tax cut plan. When the sticker price shocked some fiscal hawks, he quickly modified it to be more like the plan that congressional Republicans have put forward. He crafted a tax credit to help working families, really only after his daughter offered sort of vaporware at the GOP convention. So this is not somebody who has spent a lot of time worrying about the details of policy.
You know, it's interesting to think as we do now about what a Trump presidency might look like, what a cabinet might look like. A lot of so-called establishment Republicans or establishment leaders, even when you think about the Pentagon, people stayed away from Trump as the nominee. Mike Flynn, who's sometimes floated as someone who might be Secretary of Defense, he's not so popular with certain segments of the Pentagon. It does make you think if this is an inevitability, if other people who castigated Trump will now say, okay, now I got to get on board.
Well,
now
sure,
this is the guy.
It's just human nature to accommodate yourself to power. I mean, I think that should be expected. I think there will be people who this was such a moral choice for so many people, including, many conservatives and Republicans. I'm sure there are people who will refuse to work for Donald Trump, but many of them will. Some of them will out of a sense of patriotism. I mean, somebody has to run the government and somebody has to make sure that we don't start a nuclear war by mistake or whatever.
There will be people
who will accommodate themselves.
There have been some names floated. Newt Gingrich for Secretary of State, Rudy Giuliani for Attorney General. These are big personalities. But one thing I think is important to keep in mind is Trump is a guy who likes to keep the spotlight on himself. So I don't think you're going to see a lot of really powerful cabinet secretaries taking power away from the White House. You think about Trump when he talked about not needing Jay-Z to be on stage with him. I'm here all by myself. That's kind of his MO.
He has really been a micromanager in this campaign. And so, Scott Horsley, when you're overseeing a huge bureaucratic machine like the federal government, how do you relinquish control at that level when you're used to being such a micromanager?
Well, I mean, and this is a guy, he ran his campaign with a tenth of the staff that Hillary Clinton did. The Trump Organization is also a very lean organization for a business of its size. So he is someone who keeps
many of the senior officials in the Trump Organization are members of his own family.
That's right. And for example, the chief operating officer is a fellow who was working security at the U.S. Open when Trump spotted him and decided to bring him on staff as a bodyguard. And he then rose through the ranks to COO. So a lot of the Trump helpers, and this is true of his business and his campaign, are folks sort of long on loyalty to Donald Trump, not necessarily long on formal credentials. And it'll be interesting when you scale that up to an organization the size of the federal government.
You know, when we talk about the various wings of the Republican Party, there are the hawks, there are the fiscal conservatives. One wing that we had not really talked about until the Trump campaign is what has at times been called the alt-right, what has at times been called white supremacists, which most mainstream Republicans would not go near, and Donald Trump really courted more than most. To what extent does that get reflected in a potential Trump administration if, in fact, he wins?
We don't know. I mean, there are so many things that we don't know. What about all the things that, Donald Trump will normalize, you know, and things that he says that, you know, one of the memes or the themes of this campaign was how many falsehoods or inaccuracies, or some people called them outright lies, you know, were uttered by Donald Trump on a daily basis. I mean, he's going to have the biggest megaphone in the world on the planet.
This is a guy who's written in his book, you know, the Art of the Deal. He thinks innocent hyperbole and stretching the truth about the size of your building or the size of your bank account or, as we've seen during the campaign, the size of your rally crowd is just good marketing. And,
right.
And harm in that.
We just have no idea, though, at this point.
Yeah, we have no idea, neither does
Trump, but Donald Trump, you know, is somebody who has this innate desire to be liked. He doesn't necessarily have, like, a firm set of policies that and ideology that he's lived by his entire life. And if he wants to be liked and try to appeal to people as president, if he were to win and try to govern, then, you know, there's the possibility that he would try to work with the Republican majorities that he has to try to get the kind of legislation through that's, you know, normal, typical Republican kinds of legislation. But we have no idea what that would mean for foreign policy in particular, and how he would manage that, or who he'd put in charge. I mean, Mike Flynn as defense secretary, certainly been a highly controversial figure in his own right and at the Pentagon.
Let's go now to Michael Steele. He's a GOP strategist with Hamilton Place Strategies. He's on the line now. Mr. Steele, what do you make of tonight?
I'm absolutely shocked. I think that this is a scenario that I don't think anyone that I've spoken to in the past several weeks has seriously contemplated. And I'm blown away both by the antipathy that working-class white voters seem to have for Secretary Clinton and the fact that the entire political punditry axis in the United States completely missed it.
You're the communications director for John Boehner. You've worked closely with Paul Ryan. What does this mean for their wing of the Republican Party?
Well, it's an enormous challenge and enormous opportunity. I think that as you have been discussing, Donald Trump doesn't have detailed policy proposals. He is at the moment broadly supportive of most, not all, but much of their conservative Republican agenda. But I think it's going to fall to Speaker Ryan and what looks like will still be there's going to be a lot of responsibility on their shoulders to set the agenda beyond the broad themes that Trump has enunciated.
And to be a counterweight to him, I hear you saying. In some
cases. I think that it's less of a counterweight and more of a reality check. A lot of the things that Trump has proposed are not realistic. It's not totally clear whether he doesn't realize that or whether he does realize that but believes that the best negotiating tactic is to set a standard that he knows will never be met. You know, whether it's a big, beautiful wall or a $10 trillion tax cut.
I'm curious, Michael, did you think that Trump couldn't win with this kind of campaign or that he shouldn't win with this kind of a campaign that sort of divides, vilifies, you know, is more xenophobic than the Republicans you've worked for have been?
I didn't think it would work. I thought that obviously I think it's morally wrong, but I didn't think it would work. I thought that that there was no way to boost white turnout to the point that the sort of northern Rust Belt strategy would be successful. I thought that the only realistic path to a Republican presidency was recreating something like the 2004 George W. Bush model, where you rely on, you know, 30% or even better support from Latino voters.
Just briefly, Michael, it could be a Republican sweep. Are you not happy?
I'm extremely thrilled with the success in both the Senate and the House. I think that I have so many questions about Donald Trump and how he'll govern, and it's we're taking a step into the abyss.
Yeah.
The comparison to the British vote on Brexit is apt. In
lots of questions. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time, Michael Steele, GOP strategist. You're listening to him on special coverage from NPR News.
That's Rachel Martin in Washington, along with Ari Shapiro. Tonight, 12:15, now on an early Wednesday morning. And this is Minnesota Public Radio News coverage of election night 2016. We're going to go right away to Brian Bax, who is at Democratic headquarters, where DFL Chairman Ken Martin spoke not long ago. Brian Bax?
Yeah, I caught up with him on the sidelines here, and he conceded that the House will remain in Republican hands and that the DFL is fighting for dear life to hang on to the state Senate. Those both had been the big battles in Minnesota, and the DFL was high on picking up the House going into this election, but Ken Martin says that this wave that has swept across much of the country has hit here as well. Now they're worried, and they say that they hope that Tim Walz still holds on to the congressional seat in the 1st Congressional District, and they're looking hard at the 8th District as well.
All right, and we're looking hard at the 8th District. Brian Bax with the DFLers in Minneapolis, thank you. The 8th District, Rick Nolan ahead, 52% of the vote to Stuart Mills's 48, but 74% of the precincts reporting that race has not yet been called. And our Mark Sedeklik is with the Nolan campaign in Baxter. Mark, what are you hearing there?
Well, Tom, I'll tell you, it's a very thin crowd here. The congressman was out talking quite a while ago, asking everybody to keep the faith. He made it very clear to me that if Hillary Clinton were not at the top of the ticket, he thinks he'd be in a much better position. And if he were getting the kind of vote numbers that Hillary Clinton has gotten in the 8th District, he'd have no chance of winning. He does say he's outperforming areas where he performed poorly last time around. So, in other words, if he was losing an area to Mills 2 years ago, he's not losing by as much, he claims. And it's also very clear that there's some ticket splitting going on. There are people voting for Donald Trump and also voting for Rick Nolan. But Everybody's expecting a late night, and it is very close.
All right, Mark Sedeklik, thanks so much. And Dan Crocker is with the Stuart Mills campaign in Nisswa. And not long ago, Dan, you tweeted what Mark just mentioned as well. Ticket splitting pretty obvious there tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's still quite a few people here at the Nolan or at the Mills headquarters. And a lot of mixed emotions, Tom, because, you know, people are super excited about how Trump is performing a historic night, but they're also nervous about where their man Stuart Mills stands. So some mixed emotions here. And we've been told that we're not expecting to see Stuart Mills until later tonight, probably like 2 years ago after 1 o'clock. So it's going to be a late night here as well.
Thanks, okay. Dan Crocker, Mike Mulcahy's here as well.
And as is Maureen Shaver, our Republican analyst, Todd Rapp, our DFL analyst. Maureen, I wanted to ask you a little bit about an issue we talked about earlier, and that is this health care, MinSure, Obamacare. It seemed to be an issue Republicans really hammered on in these campaigns for the House, and it must have worked.
It clearly was an issue that came up mid-month when Governor Dayton talked about the Affordable Care Act and made the statement that the Affordable Care Act was no longer affordable. In almost every race in Minnesota, Republicans made that an issue, and they did a very effective ad campaign, I think, at the end of the race that obviously resonated. And we may see the Minnesota Senate flip, too.
Mm-hmm. Todd Rapp, what do you think about that healthcare issue?
I agree with Maureen. There was not a statewide candidate this year. The presidential candidates didn't visit very much. I don't think any of the caucuses really defined one key issue. And then late in the campaign, the insurance rates come out. Statements are made that probably people regret now. But it really galvanized, I think, swing voters around a single issue. And particularly in greater Minnesota, I think it's one of the things that's kind of the tipping point this year.
And as we mentioned, some of these congressional candidates in greater Minnesota seeing a tough battle tonight. Tim Walz, the Democrat in the 1st District, just less than 3,000 votes ahead of his Republican challenger, Jim Hagedorn.
Right.
And also Colin Peterson in the 7th District. He's in a fairly tight race with Dave Hughes, the Republican, 52-48% right now.
And also the second district, we should mention Dakota County having some problems tonight with reporting the tallies. And that would certainly impact the second congressional district. Right now, only 50% of the vote is in. This is in the southern Twin Cities metro.
Yeah, it may be one reason we haven't seen a call on the presidential race, too.
Exactly.
It's a big county.
But Jason Lewis ahead 51% to Angie Craig's 41%. It's 1220.
From NPR News, this is live election coverage. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Donald Trump is getting closer to winning the White House. He's got 244 electoral votes to Hillary Clinton's 215. We're waiting to hear from Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan.
Republicans are officially keeping control of their majority in the House, which was widely expected. They are also close to retaining hold of the Senate, but there are still a number of competitive races we're watching.
We're going to take stock of all of this, and we're going to do it with Domenico Montanaro. He is NPR senior political editor. He's in the studio with us. Domenico.
Hi there.
Hi.
We have a call from the Associated Press, and it's in the key Senate race in Pennsylvania. Republican Pat Toomey is projected to retain his seat. And it may be not surprising, considering that Donald Trump right now is ahead in Pennsylvania, which is a big surprise. And, you know, a lot of people thought there was no way that someone like Pat Toomey or Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire could survive if Donald Trump were to lose by a lot in those states. Well, he's not. And he wins. So, you know, it seems all but assured now that Republicans will retain the Senate.
In fact, I think now we can go beyond all but assured.
Got it. So I was wondering, I was saying, you know, I don't know how they're not calling it yet, with all due restraint.
Actually assured.
So we can officially call it. Republicans retain
control. So the Republicans will retain control of the Senate, and they will retain control of the House. And if Donald Trump wins, then you will have unified control. And, you know, we should look back to 2009 when Barack Obama had numbers. The only time that really things get done in this country is when one party has big numbers or if there's some kind of crisis. And, you know, the only caveat here is that Democrats will still have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, unlike in 2009 when Al Franken wound up winning that really tight race in Minnesota, and he was the 60th vote and health care passed.
And at this point, what will it take for Donald Trump to secure the White House?
At this point, you know, Donald Trump would have to win, and he's ahead in Wisconsin, which would be a key block. He's ahead in Michigan right now. He's also ahead in Pennsylvania. So, you know, he's at 244 electoral votes. That's fairly close to what he needs, the 270 that he needs. And it makes it a much more narrow path for Hillary Clinton.
Mara Liasson, what did Donald Trump and his inner circle know about the American electorate that the press didn't know, that establishment Republicans didn't know, that professional pollsters didn't know?
I think that Donald Trump did a mind meld with a certain part of the Republican electorate. But I don't know if there was something that Donald Trump knew that I think Donald Trump and his team are just as surprised as everybody else is tonight. I really do. I think they had an inkling, and there were some Republicans who still thought that the white vote was big enough in the United States, even though it was shrinking relatively, that you could eke out one more election based on the white vote, which Donald Trump appears to have done or is on the way to doing. But I think that they understood, what Donald Trump understood starting in the primaries was there was tremendous anger at the elites, at the system, at globalization, at changing demographics. I mean, his type of politics has been described as reactionary populism. In other words, it's a populist revolt, but it wants to go back to a time, as he says, make America great again, when there were manufacturing jobs, when, you know, white non-college people could support a family. I mean, all of those things. Now, it'll be really interesting if the vote for Donald Trump is just, as people have said, a big middle finger at the system, and as Sarah's voter suggested, even if he doesn't do the things he promised, it's okay. Mm-hmm. They just want their guy in there. They've kind of expressed themselves. They have someone who's their voice. You know, then maybe he can have a successful presidency.
We're going to go now to NPR's Tamara Keith, who has been at Clinton headquarters all night at the Javits Center in New York. And Tam, that place has a big glass ceiling that everybody was talking about all night as a metaphor for the glass ceiling that Hillary Clinton was planning to smash tonight. Mm. It must look a little different right now.
Yeah, the metaphor holds. The glass ceiling is firmly intact. And I think people are here, you know, supporters, many of them are feeling the weight of that glass ceiling. Because they thought it was going to happen. They thought that, you know, they've gone their whole lifetime and they didn't think it was possible. And then they let themselves believe that it was possible. And now it's not possible at this moment. You know, a couple of women I talked to said that, you know, they knew it would be hard, and that, you know, like, it's always hard for women was sort of their message. And another woman I spoke to, she's gay, she lives in Texas, and she's scared to death about what this election says about America.
Well, I was gonna
and
ask
her
about,
place in it.
I was going to ask about that, because Hillary Clinton and her supporters so often said that Donald Trump was not just another Republican candidate, but that he was fundamentally unfit for the presidency. And now that they are looking at the real prospect of a Donald Trump presidency, is it different from, you know, a Mitt Romney presidency or a John McCain presidency from their point of view?
Absolutely. And they don't know what to expect. They are afraid when it comes to national security. And the idea that, you know, that the checks and balances are potentially gone with a Republican Senate and a Republican president and you know, in short order after that, potentially a more conservative Supreme Court, that scares a lot of the people in this room.
And so what do they do? What are people talking about? I mean, what, you know, beyond anxiety and fear, what are you hearing?
Well, some people are saying that they are going to work harder, to turn it around the next time. Other people say that they need to begin figuring out how to repair America. That, you know, obviously for months we've been saying that this election has revealed great fissures in this country and wounds that we thought were healed or healing that it turns out were not. And so there's definitely some resolve among some of the people in this room to try to figure out a way to bring America together. And Hillary Clinton is still expected at some point to find her way into this room. I'm not sure who will be left.
Is it emptying out already?
It's been emptying out for hours. I mean, there were people who were just stressed out and didn't want to be here in this big room with other people feeling the way they were feeling about the way the results were coming in.
NPR's Tamara Keith, thanks.
Joining us now is Zoe Clark. She's the host of It's Just Politics at Michigan Radio. Zoe, Michigan, we still haven't called Michigan. How's it looking from where you sit?
Yeah, Rachel, it's close. Right now, as of about 5 minutes ago, Trump 48%, Hillary Clinton 46.9%.
Did you expect it to be that close in your state?
No, absolutely not. You know, I think, though, we're seeing that anything can happen in Michigan this year. Hillary Clinton was 99% of winning the Michigan primary on March 8th, and Bernie Sanders ended up winning. So I think what we're seeing this election year, though, is anything can happen in Michigan, and particularly when you think about Macomb County being the home of the infamous Reagan Democrats, that we're really seeing that right now in 2016 here.
For listeners who don't know, tell me about Macomb County.
Sure. Macomb County, working class. These are blue-collar workers. These are what, you know, right now, lately, we've thought is sort of the labor movement. But what we're seeing is, as we're seeing across the country, you know, non-college-educated whites turning out huge. Oakland County, which has always sort of been a swing county, not nearly as close for Hillary Clinton as it was for Barack Obama in 08 and 12. Now, I should know, Rachel, 67% of Wayne County in Michigan has been counted, and Wayne County is where Detroit is. Mm-hmm. So we're still waiting for those votes to count up.
But so interesting, I just heard you know, talk about the labor movement. I mean, once a solid Democratic voting bloc, it makes you wonder if it's all different now.
You know, Rachel, yes and no. I mean, I think the hot take is to say, well, the labor movement is shifting. What I wonder more about is if it has to do with the anger, right? And this is what we've talked about since the beginning of this election cycle.
But this was
Bernie
a protest
Sanders,
vote.
Donald Trump, mm-hmm. Pulling up into that anger that folks feel like jobs are going away, that you know their salary doesn't quite make it like it used to. And so whether or not that has to do, let's say, with unions and more about what they look at as a system that isn't reaching them, that isn't, you know, D.C. is too far away and is not hearing, you know, their frustration.
Zoe Clark is the host of It's Just Politics at Michigan Radio. Zoe, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Rachel.
And we're joined now by Doug Elmets, who was a speechwriter for President Reagan. He's now president of Elmets Communications. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are a Reagan conservative, and you've said that you were planning on voting for Hillary Clinton. So,
well, I've never voted for a Democrat until today, and I voted for Hillary Clinton. I spoke at the Democratic convention and sort of railed away at Donald Trump. And I, like probably a lot of other people that I may have given cover to because I was supporting Hillary before it was cool, are stunned. But, you know, I just would say that it's an understatement to say that Trump was underestimated.
Why do you think the whole country underestimated him?
Well, I do think the whole country underestimated him, and I think that the bigger challenge for Donald Trump is how he's going to heal the divisions that clearly exist in the country. I mean, imagine if you're a Muslim or a Latino.
Do you think he has interest in healing those divisions? Aren't those divisions part of what has put him within arm's reach of the White House?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think that it is, if you are any of those interesting, you know, those demographics, you're going to wonder how you fit into America. And that, I think, is going to be his challenge, which is to find that common ground, to heal these divisions, to make everybody feel as if they're welcome in this country. You know, I mean, it is going to be an amazing 4 years, for sure.
It sounds as though you're still trying to imagine him turning into the kind of Republican you would have been willing to vote for, but he never has been that kind of Republican.
No, he hasn't. In fact, I've maintained all along that he has hijacked the Republican Party and turned it into the party of Trump. So now it will be interesting to see how the party manages to either change him or he changes the party permanently.
But, you know, I think a Trump supporter might say this Republican Party you speak of kept losing national elections, whether it was John McCain or Mitt Romney, and whatever this party of Trump is seems to have done pretty well.
Totally. I mean, they won by overwhelming margins, both in the what appears to be the Electoral College and certainly the popular vote.
So why isn't it the rest of the country's job to get on board rather than the GOP elites who are never on board to say, now you need to do X, Y, Z, Mr. Trump?
Well, I think that that's fine for some Republicans, but for this Republican who looks at the Republican Party platform that was anti-gay, anti-women, anti-immigrant, those aren't the views that I hold, and frankly, I don't think they're the views that a lot of Republicans who refuse to vote for Donald Trump hold. So maybe there's going to be a division within the Republican Party, maybe not. But it will be interesting to see how this all evolves. And I will say this, that if he is elected president, we all need to rally around him, for better or worse, because he will be the leader of this country, and that's what a democracy is all about.
Will you still consider yourself a member of his party, a Republican?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, it really is difficult. Just given where the Republican Party platform is, it's going to take a little bit of time. I just wonder whether many of us who are in a similar situation to me are going to wake up after 24 hours and feel as if we still have this really serious hangover.
And what kinds of text messages are you getting from other prominent Republicans tonight?
Well, many of them are similar to sort of the things that I've expressed. They're stunned. They're disappointed. Many of them feel as if they want to vomit, candidly. But I would say that some of the emails and text messages I've gotten are from people who are Trump supporters, who are gloating.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But Doug Elmets, former speechwriter for President Reagan, now president of Elmets Communications.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We've got more coverage to come. Stay with us for more special coverage of Election 2016 from NPR News.
We're going to bring in NPR's Asma Khalid now, who joins us in the studio. Asma, you've been looking at exit polling. The word poll has a new meaning right now because so many of them have been wrong.
I know. And Rachel, even as I'm looking at these, you know, I was just out there talking to my editor saying, gosh, like, what do I know and what do I don't know? And things are so confusing. So I've been trying to pay more attention to sort of big top line trends.
Yeah.
Right. And what did we see in various states? And one thing I will say that to me is interesting, I'm a native Midwesterner. I grew up in the Midwest. And when I was growing up, we sort of saw the Midwest has scattered. I grew up in Indiana. You see some places that were red, some places that were blue. Mm-hmm. Tonight, we're seeing overwhelmingly a sort of red burst of color across the Midwest. You know, not all the states have been called yet, but so far it looks like Illinois is the one sort of blue spot in the middle of the country. And that's largely because we do seem to see a shift in how white blue-collar voters have voted. I was looking at states in which Barack Obama won the vote in 2008 among white non-college voters. That would be states like Iowa, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Tonight, according to all the exit polls, Donald Trump seems to have won that group and won them by humongous margins. Like a state like Wisconsin, he's up 31 points.
So did Hillary Clinton not come close at all to repeating the Obama coalition?
So I guess in white working class were really never, you know, a key part, you could say, of the Obama coalition. But I think that Obama was able to galvanize a really disparate group of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at a state like Michigan or Wisconsin, it was interesting because those states have, you know, some African Americans, but really Obama did win a majority of white working class voters. But the key constituencies, I think, of the Obama coalition were millennial voters, women, and African Americans. What we saw tonight, particularly among millennial voters, is that a number of them seemed to choose a third party candidate in some pretty key states.
We haven't talked a lot about that. So Gary Johnson running as, you know, a third party option for a lot of disgruntled Republicans. How did he fare?
So, you know, I was looking earlier at a state like Florida. He seemed to have captured about, I think it was 7%, you could say, or he or other, you know, Jill Stein
on the left,
you know,
yeah.
Folks who said that they didn't want to say who they voted for. And I think it was in Michigan about 10% of the vote earlier on when I was looking among people under the age of 29 opted for either Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. And what's interesting is that if you look at overall how folks voted, it doesn't seem to be that Donald Trump captured a whole bunch of, you know, more of millennials. It's just that Hillary Clinton seems to have underperformed Barack Obama.
So that enthusiasm gap was real.
Mm-hmm.
People who she needed didn't show up to do the work for her.
And I think that's really key in states where we saw young voters actually outperform the country. And that's what we saw in a state like Florida. We actually saw in 2012 that young voters came out and they supported Barack Obama in bigger margins than what young voters on average did in the country. And this election cycle, that doesn't seem to be the case.
Real quick,
Tom. One thing to add to that, if you look at Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Detroit, Hillary Clinton far under where Barack Obama was in those places. And we know that they were trying to turn out the black vote. It doesn't look like they were able to get them out at the numbers that they needed.
Much more to come. You are listening to special coverage of Election 2016 on NPR News.
That's Rachel Martin in Washington. I'm Tom Cran here with Mike Mulcahy. Well into a Wednesday morning now, 38 minutes into a Wednesday morning as we continue our coverage here on Minnesota Public Radio News. And Mike, we are still looking at some races that are too close to call here in the state.
Right. And the primary one, the race for president.
Exactly.
Hillary Clinton has seen a lead early in the night erode a bit. She now has 47% of the vote compared to Donald Trump's 45%, with 87% of the precincts reporting. And a big reason we don't know the answer yet is that Dakota County has not reported a single vote yet tonight. And that's the same reason we don't know what's really happening in the second congressional district. We know there's right. a race there, but only 52% of the precincts have reported this far after the polls closed. Jason Lewis, the Republican, is leading Angie Craig, the Democrat, by 50-42%, with Paula Overby of the Independence Party coming in with 8%. But Dakota County is in that second district, so we need to hear what's happening in Dakota County before we can know what's happening in these races.
Would settle a couple, including where the 10 electoral votes, or to whom the 10 electoral votes in Minnesota go, because neither Donald Trump, who's had a very good night, or Hillary Clinton have the 270 needed to be the next president of the U.S. And so Minnesota, one of those states that hangs in the balance with its 10 electoral votes. We'll continue to monitor.
From NPR News, this is Live Election Coverage. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Republicans have clinched control of the House and the Senate, and Donald Trump is hoping to ride that Republican wave to the White House.
All eyes are now on a few Midwestern states that could clinch the presidency for Donald Trump. We are also getting word now, AP confirming Donald Trump has also won the state of Pennsylvania.
And speaking of the White House, NPR's Parth Shah is there at the White House right now, and he joins us on the line. Parth, can you hear me?
I can, Ari. How are you?
I'm fine. What's the scene there?
Well, there's a huge crowd that has been growing constantly over the past hour. I'm standing at the far back of it, and some of the people I've spoken to, most of the people out here are college age. People have described it as kind of like a frat party. A lot of chanting, and most of that chanting is actually anti-Trump. But from some of the people I've spoken to, there's a fair share of pro-Trump chanting that's going on, too. It's loud. The crowd is constantly growing, but it doesn't seem like anything has gotten violent.
All right, I want to bring in everybody who is here in the room with us. We have Asma Khalid, Mara Liasson, and Domenico Montanaro, and it's been such an unexpected evening. As we're getting close to the 2 a.m. hour, Mara, how do you explain the utter reversal we have seen tonight from the last year and a half of polls, predictions, analysis?
Well, I don't know if anybody has a really good prediction yet, except for the explanations we've heard that white college voters were under-polled, the models were wrong, they didn't assume that they'd turn out in the numbers that they did, although it wasn't necessarily that turnout was up among them, it's just that he got such an astronomical number, he broke all records. And also, you know, this has been so unexpected because every institution in America, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the professional pollsters, the media didn't expect this to happen. And I think, you know, you just heard a Republican who was voting for Hillary Clinton said it makes him feel like he wants to vomit. And the question that you asked him about how's Donald Trump going to heal the divisions when he ran on an explicitly divisive campaign, that was his secret sauce, that he tapped into the anger of white non-college voters. I think this will be a real test for Democratic institutions and Democratic values and civility.
Well, a test
and
for
inclusion.
Democratic institutions, are you talking about American democracy? Like, when you say test for Democratic institutions, are you talking about a test for American democracy as such?
Well, what I'm saying is that we don't know. We know the things that Donald Trump has said on the campaign trail about democratic institutions. We know what he feels about the free press. He wants to change the libel laws. He thinks the media is corrupt. We know that he doesn't believe that a judge whose parents were born in Mexico could judge him fairly. He doesn't really believe in an independent judiciary. We know that he thinks that he can order the military to commit waterboarding and worse, is what he said, things that are patently illegal under the Geneva Convention. I mean, we know all these things. We don't know how much he will enact. But also the great irony of all the many, many ironies of tonight is that Donald Trump was maybe democratically elected, and you just heard somebody who was against him saying we have to rally around him because that's what we do in a democracy. This is the candidate who said he would not necessarily accept the conclusion of this democratic election unless he won.
Can we talk about Pennsylvania for just a second?
Yeah, let's talk about Pennsylvania, which we just called has gone, Associated Press has just called has gone for Donald Trump, which has not gone for a Republican since when?
1988. I was going to say, we kind of glazed past that, like from the break, by the way, you know, like.
P.S. Pennsylvania.
No, like Pennsylvania was a huge deal, right? I mean, this is a place that has not gone Republican since 1988, as we just talked about. And obviously the reason that the Associated Press was able to call it is because it's 99% in. in Philadelphia, and Hillary Clinton was off from what Barack Obama did, close but off, about 20,000 or so votes short of what Barack Obama was able to do. You've seen that in across a lot of the states that she needed, where in the big city she wasn't able to get out the vote that she needed. But I will say this: what's fascinating is that the usual counties that you look at as swing states, Hillary Clinton in a lot of places hit her marks. Bucks County. Everyone talked about Bucks County, Pennsylvania. What was going on? She's ahead in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, where what you're seeing is sort of a red tide rising, where, you know, we talk about a lot of those red counties throughout the state that didn't have many votes, but you saw a lot more of them as they propelled Trump to victory.
Awesome. You want to jump
in? And Domenico, I think maybe the counter to that, though, and you were saying this earlier, is that Hillary Clinton wasn't really able to bring out the voters that she needed. I was just looking at some of the turnout figures around African-American voters. According to the exit polls right now out of Pennsylvania, it looks like only 10% of the voters were African-American. It was 13% 4 years ago. That's a problem.
Can I just ask, a few big states are still outstanding. We're not calling the presidential race yet, but without Pennsylvania, does Hillary Clinton have much of a path at all?
She has to win everything else.
Everything else.
Arizona, we haven't talked about much. It's still out. And I find it fascinating that Arizona at this late hour has not been called, and Pennsylvania has. I mean, this is we are seeing a political transformation here. I think that you have seen Latinos definitely go out to the polls. You've seen Arizona, Nevada, you know, places like that where normally you would think would be either more competitive or leaning Republican, not. And you're seeing instead in the Midwest this path that I've called earlier the trade winds path for Donald Trump, where this populist nativist message, anti-establishment message, has really resonated with a lot of voters, people who have felt disaffected from the political system, who really dislike the elites, and what Mara was talking about when it comes to institutions.
I got to say, you call it the trade winds path, and yet nearly every major swing state has gone for Donald Trump. It's not path so much as it is a wash. I mean, Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Iowa, Pennsylvania. It is this long, long list of formerly blue, now red states.
But you know what we also don't know? The Brexit analogy is so interesting, mm-hmm. because what Brexit really was something that starkly divided British society. Young against old, rural against urban, educated against non-educated. And I have a feeling that when Ozma's finished sifting through all the data, maybe she'll confirm this, but there were deep divisions on age and gender and race and class, and education in America has now become a proxy for class.
Mm-hmm. You know,
the more highly educated, the more you're a Democrat. Yeah. And one of Donald Trump's most famous sayings was, "I love the poorly educated."
I mean,
he knew where his voters were coming from.
As you know, I spent a couple of years living in London, and after the Brexit vote, by which point I was already living back here, one of my good friends in the UK said to me, "This is the first time politics has ever made me cry," after his country voted to leave the EU. And it would not surprise me if tonight's vote has that impact for many.
Well, you heard him say, it makes me feel like I want to vomit. There are many people that felt that Donald Trump didn't represent American values of tolerance, inclusion, civility.
But at the same time, what you saw in that Brexit vote and what you've seen here is that there are people who feel left out of globalization, of immigration trends. There is a real fear that we've talked about that he was able to exploit. But I don't think we can diminish it
to that point, though. Yeah. I think what Mara is saying is so accurate in terms of an age divide. I mean, look, where Hillary Clinton didn't do well with millennials, it's not that she lost those voters to Donald Trump. It's that she potentially might have lost them to a third-party candidate. I mean, overwhelmingly, we see millennials tilt sort of more liberal, even on social issues, on immigration issues. And so we do see a divide already in the exit polls among voters over the age of 40 who
support Trump. Which goes back to the Democrats clearing the field for her.
And all of the problems that the Republican Party and the autopsy report and other conversations have laid out as long-term problems for the party. If you're not for doing something about global warming, if you're not for gay marriage, although we don't really know where Donald Trump is actually probably pro-gay marriage. Yeah. I think he said some things about that. But if you're not for these things or for immigration reform, then young people are going to tune you out. Those problems haven't gone away. This was, as Domenico said, kind of red states rising, or you could call it the revenge of the Reagan Democrats. But this is a divided country, and one half, or a little more than half, who felt left out has now grabbed back the control.
See, you know, all year we've been talking about GOP in crisis, civil war within the Republican Party, wither the GOP. Should we now be asking Democratic Party in crisis,
no,
wither the Democrats?
I really don't think so. I think that the Republican Party still isn't sure what it wants. Now it's going to be remade in a Trumpian image. It'll be a protectionist, more isolationist, nativist party, I think, unless he changes once he gets into the White House. The Democratic Party still believes in, you know, diversity, and that we should do something about global warming, and that the government should help people pay for college and get health care.
But is the DNC going to seek out people to run who aren't establishment politicians, people who have a more outsider kind of appeal?
The big question for the DNC, and they'll probably have one of those "what just happened to us" commissions, which every losing party does, mm-hmm. is, you know, why did they fail? Was it Hillary Clinton? And I think you're going to she was the ultimate status quo past candidate in a race that was supposed to be about the future and change.
And right. There was no room for anyone else.
And who is that that's going to suddenly appear from the Democratic Party, you know, and appear to be the person who can? I think there is going to be some Democratic hand-wringing. One thing on the rural-urban divide, we should note, it was huge tonight, okay? I mean, 62-34 for Trump, people who live in rural areas, 59-35 for Clinton, for people who live in urban areas. That's a 52-point rural-urban gap. Nothing may be bigger than that.
You know, and one figure that I saw so much earlier this evening that I don't remember the exact number, but it stood out to me, is the very high percentage of Americans who don't know anyone who is voting for the opposite candidate
for. And here's another poll, little polling data point, is 90% of each candidate's supporters said that they couldn't support or feel good about the other candidate being president. That means that, you know, whoever comes into office, as we've said this before, is not only going to have the highest disapproval ratings of any new president in American history, but they are going to have a tremendously hard time unifying the country because so many people, because we're so tribal and so divided, and so many of their opponent supporters are not ready to even give them the benefit of the doubt.
Also, can I just chime in real quick on the, you know, Democratic hand-wringing or not hand-wringing? And to me, what's really interesting, and Domenico and I have talked about this so many times, is demography, right? And this election was supposed to be the election that had the smallest share of the white electorate.
And it might have been.
America's younger,
America's
browner.
But still, yeah. But even if it did, it's still, say, 70% white. And what I think is really interesting is, you know, I've seen sort of younger Republican pollsters tonight on Twitter saying, yes, this is a winning strategy for now. It'll win you now. It might win you next, you know, the next election too, but it's not a long-term game plan. But I think on the reverse side for Democrats, if you are losing white voters by consistently large margins, that's also not a really winning strategy for the short term.
There are some out there, I imagine, Mara, who are saying, how do you go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump to...
Well,
two,
you know, it's very
more
common.
Opposite men, could you not find?
Well, it's very common that each president is kind of a reaction against
right.
the
Think about
the,
Bush the
pendulum.
And Obama.
Yeah, yeah, the pendulum swings a little far, and sometimes the new president overreacts to the failings of the previous one and goes too far in the opposite direction. But Donald Trump has been called by Republicans as well as Democrats the least prepared president, least qualified president, the least curious, intellectually curious, willing to do the work of policy, all those things. Now, he is going to be the most powerful person on the planet if, in fact, he's elected president tonight. So we are entering totally uncharted territories. As your interviewee said recently, it's like looking into the abyss.
What does it mean for Obama's legacy?
Well, his legacy is going to be chipped away at pretty fast in pretty short order.
Think about Obamacare. Mm-hmm. You know, think about all the executive orders that the president has put into order. That's
suspending deportations.
Right. First thing off the bat is what Donald Trump said that he's going to go after. So, you know, and you can all be almost guaranteed that, you know, in the Senate, in a Republican-controlled Senate, that they will try to pass some sort of repeal of Obamacare, and they'll do it through reconciliation if they have to, which would only require 51 votes.
We're speechless at this moment.
Did anybody think that at 5 minutes to two on the night of the election, we still would not have heard an acceptance or
we should say we're
going
to hear from John Podesta shortly at Clinton headquarters, according to reports.
Some of the cables, yeah.
Someone's got to go out there. As Tamara Keith said, there are still some people who are waiting at the Javits Center. Stay with us. We are bringing you the news when we've got it and analysis of this incredible election. We've got Mara Liasson in the studio, Domenico Montanaro in the studio, Asma Khalid, Ari Shapiro is here with me. Stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to special coverage of the 2016 election here on NPR News.
Twelve fifty-four Central Time, early on a Wednesday morning, the 9th of November. Our live coverage continues here on Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Tom Cran here with Mike Mulcahy. We're still on the air with you because while we don't know who the next president of the U.S. is going to be, we also don't know to whom the 10 electoral votes here in Minnesota are going. We also have a few other questions unresolved. Mike, what
Absolutely.
Do you see?
Well, it's a very tight race for president in Minnesota right now. 89% of the precincts are reporting, and Hillary Clinton has a 47 to 45% lead. That's about a 43,000 vote lead over Donald Trump right now. So, too close to call.
Yeah.
And, also, some of these congressional seats still too close to call. We should report that Colin Peterson has been declared the winner in the 7th District by the Associated Press. But we're still looking at the 1st District, which is another tight race here tonight. Tim Walz, the Democratic incumbent, with 90% of the precincts reporting, it's basically a 50-50 tie. He's got about 1,200 votes over his Republican opponent, Jim Hagedorn. So we're keeping an eye on that one. We're keeping an eye on the open seat in the 2nd District. 52% of the precincts reporting there. Jason Lewis, the Republican, with 50%. Angie Craig with 42%. And Paula Overby, the Independence Party candidate, with 8%. So that one's not called yet.
And that's largely due to Dakota County. We're still waiting for results.
We're still waiting for results. And in the 8th District, northeastern Minnesota, Rick Nolan, the Democratic incumbent, has 51%, and Stuart Mills, the Republican challenger, 49%. Very close there. Looks like about maybe 5,000 votes separate the two, and 84% of the precincts reporting there. So some tight races tonight. Todd Rapp, our DFL political commentator, what do you think is happening out there, and do you think Hillary Clinton is going to win tonight, or could this be the year that Minnesota finally goes red in a presidential race?
Well, your crack team here reminded us that Barack Obama won the 2nd District by only 226 votes last time. Dakota County is going to be very, very important. If Clinton doesn't win that county, or put it this way, if she loses that county by 10,000 or 12,000 votes, she may not carry Minnesota.
So it could be the first year since 1972 that Minnesota gives its electoral votes to a Republican.
Yeah, and still, you know, she's got a healthy lead given how many precincts are left, but it's not insurmountable given that one of Minnesota's biggest counties has still not been tallied.
Maureen, what do you think of these developments?
Well, I think some of the interesting things, too, though, about the whole Trump-Clinton phenomena is that in the suburban areas where Republicans have taken over some DFL seats, the Republican is actually ahead of Donald Trump by significant amounts. I believe in the Ron Ehrhardt seat in Edina, and Sarah Anderson, Paul Anderson, actually two Andersons out in Plymouth, that they're running ahead of the presidential candidate.
So a very interesting phenomenon, then. We're seeing sort of a split between the top of the ticket and some of those down-ballot races, but the split is working different ways, but it seems to be helping Republicans in most areas.
Exactly. A handful of suburban areas, suburban counties. It's not. Otherwise, it is statewide.
And our Mark Zdeklik, who is with the Nolan campaign in northern Minnesota and Baxter, is saying that Rick Nolan has said he's going to bed for the night. He expects his lead over Stuart Mills will continue to shrink, and the race will be decided by a couple of hundred votes.
Wow.
He says he hopes it's not so close that a recount would have to be conducted. That's from our Mark Sinekalik, who was with the at Nolan headquarters in Baxter in the 8th District. So that just in the last few minutes. And also aides to Angie Craig and Paul Thiessen as well say we're unlikely to hear from either of them directly tonight representing the DFL. So we'll continue to monitor. Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Listener-supported radio with election results online at nprnews.org. Mike Mulcahy and Tom Cran still here as we approach 1 in the morning. And what are you seeing,
Mike? I was just watching that Tim Walz race again, and it is just narrowed considerably. Some more votes came in, 94% of the precincts reporting now, and it's about 150 votes apart.
Separating
it. Looks like, yeah, Tim Walz has a lead of about 150 votes right now. Incredible.
Right. That, and we're getting close. You said 97% in?
94.
94% in. We'll continue to watch that as well, but that would be in recount territory, according to the state statute, if that continues.
And it would, certainly be a big upset for Tim Walz.
Certainly would be. All right, 1 o'clock in the morning. It's Minnesota Public Radio News, Election Night 2016.